Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and coming up in Focus on Africa, we are talking about how Islamic State in the Sahel is enforcing dress and behavior codes on men and women in parts of Niger.
They clearly deem it preferable that women and girls stay at home. So in some villages, they're no longer able to collect firewood to work in the fields. The group does also impose restrictions and rules on men and boys. They are, for example, keeping young men from having their normal social gatherings in the streets to drink tea. And they tend to punish men and boys more violently.
And why did you choose to do a naked protest?
We felt like when we go naked, we shall draw attention to our demands. We wanted people to look at us and feel embarrassed. So it's the same way they should look at corruption. We are not just exposing our bodies, we are exposing corruption.
We'll be taking a closer look at the long history of so-called naked protests from the colonial era to present-day Africa. How effective are they? It's Friday, the 13th of September. First, we go to Nigeria. There are catastrophic floods in the northeast of the country. Hundreds of thousands of people have watched their children, their homes, their fields, their livestock wash away as they try to scramble to safety. Adama and Ibrahim have been describing their experiences in recent days. Adama first.
We left my husband behind when we had to cross a bridge. We don't know whether he was able to leave and go to safety because he is blind. In this camp, they cook food, but we don't get it. I have never eaten the food they distribute here because people are so disorganized and I can't fight for food with my kids with me. We have been drinking water, but we thank God.
The flood started around dawn. We had blocked where the water was coming from with bags of sand, but the water eventually forced its way. The water started flowing into our house, and it got to my chest. I have 17 kids, and 14 are here with me. Some of them were in front of me, and I held two in my arms as we left home. Their mothers held the small ones. We didn't pick any of our belongings. We just left.
Thanks to Adama and Ibrahim for taking a moment in those difficult circumstances to talk to us. The floods were one thing, but in Maiduguri, things were made considerably worse when a dam collapsed, resulting in a deluge bearing down on half of the city. The governor issued evacuation orders. It's difficult to estimate the number of fatalities, but preliminary figures suggest more than 30 people so far. Search and rescue operations are underway in Maiduguri, and those affected need to be fed and sheltered. My colleague Azizat Olulua is reporting from Maiduguri.
It's been very chaotic. You know, people are frustrated, helpless, and majorly hungry, especially the displaced persons that have gone to the settlement camps the authorities have set up for them. But the numbers keep increasing, and it seems that what the authorities are doing are just not enough. The state government is still overwhelmed, but they're getting support from international organizations and also the national government. National Emergency Management Agency first to share food. I know some other organizations are doing the same as well, but we've seen many people telling us that the essential supplies are also not getting to them. Yesterday, we went to some of the communities where people are still trapped. I saw hundreds of people tens of them on rooftops of their homes that have been submerged in water. And these people have gone for days without food and clean water because water sources have been contaminated due to the collapse of the sewages in the state capital. So there are fears of an outbreak of waterborne diseases.
We'll hear from the state governor in just a moment, but give us an idea of how bad it is, the numbers of people dying. I know that those numbers are rising, the number of people that are displaced. I mean, it seems like the infrastructure of the city basically has collapsed.
Absolutely, Audrey. The governor told me that the affected persons cannot be less than 2 million. They are estimating about 400,000 displaced persons. We're seeing that the number could go higher. And there are no official casualty figures yet, but independent agencies are estimating at least 30. The governor says they are waiting for the water to recede so that they can ascertain the level of damage. Infrastructure-wise, is worried. He said this is going to set the state back a lot because many public structures have been affected. We understand that one of the most equipped cancer centers in the country is located in Maiduguri, and it's been submerged in water. And one of the medical directors in the state, University of Maiduguri, said that there could be another potential catastrophe in the waiting because the cancer equipment may cause radiation, you know, and that is something that is a cause for concern.
So what are the authorities actually doing to help the survivors?
There seems to be a concerted effort, you know, from all angles to support these people. But like I said earlier, it seems that it's not enough because there are so many people in need. I spoke to some displaced persons in one of the IDP camps and settlement camps made for these people. And they said that they've had to sacrifice the one meal they give their family for their children. A woman, Fatima, says she has six children, for example, and she was able to get just one plate of meal and they had to share it for that day. You know, some said they got meal tickets. They've not been able to get anything. And so it's really worrisome because most of these people have been displaced from where they had to flee to due to insurgency that has ravaged the state for 15 years, you know. So it's like double jeopardy or triple jeopardy, you know. Fleeing insurgency, coming somewhere else, and now you've been dislodged by the deluge. You're in this settlement camp and you're not even getting the supplies you need to survive, basically.
So hunger, insecurity, and I believe also that the prison was breached and some of the people escaped, and there are particular worries about that.
Absolutely. Governor Zulu is particularly worried about that. He's the first public official to somehow admit that there was actually a jailbreak and some leaders of the Boko Haram insurgency group escaped.
I'm worried. Yes, I'm seriously worried. But you also have to bear in mind that Borno State Government has established what we call Borno Model of rehabilitation that has allowed many insurgents to repent. Within the last 2 years, over 200,000 Boko Haram members and their families have repented. And I think this has also yielded positive results in ensuring return of peace and stability to Borno State.
And that's the Governor General Babagana Zulu there. It seems like much of the damage was actually caused by this dam collapsing. Could it have been prevented?
I asked the governor the same question, and he said that it could have been prevented if proper dam maintenance was carried out. I understand that the Alau Dam belongs to the federal government, the national government of Nigeria. So the state government doesn't really have so much responsibility to take care of it. They only manage it with them. But the governor said that with this horrible experience, they will be forced to work with them and ensure that the National Water Resources does what is expected of them to ensure this kind of disaster never happens again.
And what about the future? These are people who've lost their crops. These are people who are now hungry. The children can't go to school. They've lived under the terror of Boko Haram and that insurgency. What next for them now?
That's the question many of us are waiting to hear the answer to. Well, as Nigerians, personally, as a mother, I am worried, and the governor is worried as well, because there would be the possibility of diseases. I saw dead bodies floating on the flood water, and in another area, someone was bathing inside the water. Someone was washing their clothes in the water. Someone was using it to clean their privates in the snow. And I've even heard that some people who were trapped were forced to drink the flood water because they didn't have access to any water. So imagine what the future holds for these people who have lost everything. They've lost all their belongings, you know, in flood water. So they need to rebuild, start afresh, basically. But Will they get the support they need? Do they even have the resources they need personally? Most of these people are very poor. They do not have access to the basic things that the average Nigerian have access to. The future looks bleak, really, to be honest.
Do you think that the government, the state government, can rise to the occasion? Because you're describing sheer desperation here.
Well, the governor already came out and said that his government cannot shoulder this alone, that it's too huge for the state authorities to handle, that they need support wherever they can get it from, that most of the funds they got in recent times that they were supposed to use to develop the states are now being diverted for this emergency situation. So imagine how this has set them back financially. So he said flatly, the state government cannot handle this situation alone. They need help.
That's the BBC's Azizat Ololua in Maiduguri. We report on the geopolitical shifts in the Sahel quite a lot here on Focus on Africa. There's a lot happening in that region that spans the largest part of the continent from west to east. We've been hearing about Russia besting France in countries like Burkina Faso, Mali and Niger. An Islamist insurgency has been raging in the region for the better part of the century. A recent report from the International Crisis Group, which follows events closely, snagged our attention with a line about the lives of women and girls in Niger. And it goes,
in recent years, an Islamic State branch has deepened its influence in rural Tillabéri near Niger's border with Mali. Women there have long navigated difficult conditions, but the jihadists have made things worse.
We thought we should take a closer look at this. So we did, with the person who compiled that report. Her name is Fleur Killiers, Senior Analyst for Gender and Conflict at the International Crisis Group. First, a quick explainer from Fleur as to which groups are operating in the region, because there's quite a tangle of them.
So in this research, we've been looking at the Islamic State Sahel province, which is one of the jihadi coalitions in the Central Sahel. It's important to say that it's actually not the most rapidly expanding one. That is an Al-Qaeda-affiliated group of jihadi organizations, which is called JNIM, which has its sort of heartland in the central Mali and has been quickly expanding from there. And for a long time, these two groups, so the Al-Qaeda-associated coalition and then the Islamic State-affiliated coalition, have been in competition with each other and have been sort of fighting it out on the battlefield. That said, ISSAHEL is very firmly embedded within a number of zones. And so this includes the Niger-Mali border, so the Abala department in Niger, which we've looked at, kind of northern Tillabéri more broadly, the Menaka region of Mali, and then also parts of northeastern Burkina Faso. And so in these zones, ISSAHEL is really the preeminent group of the two.
Now to the substance of the report. The effect IS in the Sahel is having on the lives of not just women and girls in this part of Niger, but men and boys as well.
So the way in which ISSAHEL has been asserting itself into the lives of the civilian populations that are under its influence is very gendered. So it enforces different rules on women and girls on one hand, men and boys on the other, and also different punishments. And so for women and girls specifically, there are quite strict dress code in villages that are under strong Islamic State influence. Women and girls have to wear this sort of head-to-toe black hijab that leaves only their eyes visible, a long black dress and a full-length black robe and abaya, black socks. They've also imposed restrictions on interactions between unmarried men and women. And they have also imposed a model where they clearly deem it preferable that women and girls stay at home and stay kind of confined to the domestic sphere. And so in some villages, they're no longer able to collect firewood to work in the fields. And so what this is doing is that it's further restricting women's livelihoods and their ability to participate in public life. And it's worsening longstanding gender inequality that already existed in the area. The group does also impose restrictions and rules on men and boys. Perhaps important to point that out as well. They are, for example, keeping young men from like having their normal social gatherings in the streets to drink tea. And they tend to punish men and boys more violently for infractions on rules than they do women and girls. And then there are a lot of impacts of insecurity in a broader sense, so beyond Sharia law, but the fact that a lot of schools have been closed, that it's very difficult for women to travel to health centres when they need to give birth, for instance. So it's really had a tremendous impact on their everyday lives.
Have these restrictions, the social restrictions, have they been coming on gradually or have they been there right from the start?
I think the restrictions have been communicated quite clearly from the start, but we see differences between between villages, even within a department, between different areas, in the extent to which the group is able to enforce them. And so the more isolated a village, and so this is especially the case for villages closer to the border, the less leeway people feel basically in terms of obeying the restrictions imposed by the group. Whereas in villages that are a bit closer to the main town in the department, which confusingly is also called Abala town, there might be slightly more leeway because people are not in contact with Islamic State fighters quite as often. They don't do incursions into their villages quite as often. And so people feel a little bit more flexibility.
Now, I'm wondering how you were able to gather testimonies from women in the report.
Yeah, we, of course, had to be very, very careful in going about this research. So we made sure that we explained the purpose of our research very, very well to women who we invited to speak to us, that we created a safe space for them to do so, that we are, of course, keeping all of their testimonies and their stories anonymous, because there is an enormous amount of distrust and fear among both women and men, because ISIL uses this network of informants to control populations in the areas under its influence. So they don't have kind of a permanent territorial presence. It's not like all of these villages have jihadist fighters inside the village all the time, but it's more that people feel like at any point in time they're being monitored, they're being watched, and anything that they say or do might make its way back to the group and could result in them being punished.
Let's listen to some direct quotes from people who've been affected by these changes.
The jihadists ask girls for marriage, especially in the camps around the grazing areas. But marriage will happen if the girl says yes. They also pay the bride price, but people are scared, so they don't dare say no.
As women, our political role is limited to voting. When it comes to managing conflicts, women are not called upon. Our knowledge is being underestimated.
Our children haven't been to school for 2 years. Terrorists whipped them, set school supplies on fire, and destroyed the school. The teachers were scared and left our village.
Flo told me more about how people are reacting to the jihadists' directives.
I think what I found very, very interesting is that the views of these women are very diverse and they're very nuanced. So a lot of them are very opposed to the presence of the Islamic State and to the norms that are being imposed on them. They say this is not how we traditionally dress. It is not how we want to dress. They regret they're being made to stay at home. They regret that they can't go to ceremonies and festivities anymore like they used to. But it's not the case that all women are sort of uniformly opposed to the rules that ISIL is trying to impose on these communities. Some of them say, well, actually, the norms that they impose for behavior that women and girls should have, I tend to agree with. Others say that young girls can be quite attracted or interested in a marriage with a member of the group because they actually hope that this model that the group imposes can actually give them some respite from very hard work. And then I think lastly, a very important point to come through is that when women have negative views of the group, it is less, I think, due to norms being imposed on them and on their daughters, which they might agree with. But I think what kind of grieves them most in many cases is gender-based violence against men and boys. And
it's then, very interesting, actually, and to note that. Is it to punish and intimidate them into not running away or to intimidate them into joining the group or what?
Men and boys are seen as potential recruits for jihadist groups, including the Islamic State. And so pressure might be put on them individually, but also on their families to join the group.
I hesitate to use the word, but governance seems to be close to it. Is there a state presence and then is, you know, then sort of traditional structures and then IS related structures or what?
So in terms of the state presence, what we see in Abala department, which we looked at, is similar to other parts of the region. And so basically you have the main town where, as I said, the state is in control. There are security forces permanently there which offer protection to the population, which ensure that there is continued service provision, health posts, schools, a weekly market, that kind of thing. And so this is where a lot of the displaced populations will flock to. And then outside of the main town, the rural areas see very little government presence anymore because government representatives like village chiefs, but also teachers, have really been target of ISIL. And so many of them have either disappeared or have been executed or have fled before that happened to them. In terms of governance, it seems that for the last year or so, there are some indications that ISIL is trying to improve its relation with civilians.
Fleur Colliers, Senior Analyst for Gender and Conflict.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
At the International Crisis Group. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. Now, you may have heard about our next story. Three women were arrested last Monday in Uganda during a protest on the streets of Kampala. This wasn't just any protest, though. It was one of the oldest and most powerful forms of protest women through the ages have staged. It was a naked protest. The three women in Kampala were following in the more recent footsteps of women from the colonial era Nigeria to apartheid era South Africa, Kenya, and now Uganda. Naked protest reaches back into mythical history and has made quite a comeback around the world in the last decade or so. We'll be hearing about specific examples from Africa and how effective naked protests are in just a moment. But let's first listen to one of the women who'd been arrested in Uganda for doing it. Her name is Nora Kobisinye, and when I spoke to her, she had just been released from detention following her arrest last week. She told me that the levels of corruption in Uganda were what motivated her, and she was particularly incensed by the official response to the Kitezi landfill site collapse in Kampala last month, in which scores of people died. Here is Nora's story.
How are you? You were in jail for 10 days.
Oh, I'm just trying to figure out everything just upside down, so I'm just trying.
Why were you protesting?
We were protesting against the rampant corruption in our country, particularly the government's handling of the Kitezi rubbish incident. We demanded accountability, justice and transparency in governance.
Why did you choose to do a naked protest?
We used this strategy because we felt like it was the best. We felt like when we go naked, we shall draw attention to our demands. We shall get attention from those in power to work on our concerns. But what we expected, we didn't get it.
And so you decided that you will go naked. Were you completely naked in the second protest?
We had makeup, but we didn't have blouses. We wanted people to look at us and feel embarrassed. So it's the same way they should look at corruption. We're not just exposing our bodies. We're exposing corruption.
How did you come up with the idea of doing that?
We planned the protest over a few weeks using social media and secure messaging apps to coordinate. We cannot coordinate using physical meetings because they will still arrest us.
And what was the reaction to you when you did the naked protest?
Some people supported our broad approach, while others criticized us for using nudity as a form of protest.
So what's next for the three of you that were involved in this protest?
We are going to still coordinate until we see that our country is back. Corruption is gone completely until we see that the Speaker of the Parliament of Uganda, Anita Mulongo, has resigned.
Nora Kobisinye, just out of detention there. Now for a closer look at naked protests in the last 100 years or so on the continent. Anthony Natif is an activist based in Kampala and leads a think tank called Public Square. He's been writing about naked protests. Are they effective? And if so, why?
It depends on the context, because nude protests have been a mainstay in Africa. And really, when you study them, they've been here more than 100 years. They are largely rooted in the recognition that society is patriarchal. So usually women's bodies are looked at as sacred in society, and because they are presumed to be weak, whenever they stand up against the patriarchy, they use the weapon of last resort, which is their bodies. So it's how it's been looked at over time. But as society has evolved and women have taken greater positions in leadership, and the recognition that women and men shouldn't be separated, they are equal, but opposite sexes, I feel like a nude protest, as envisaged in the past, need to evolve with the times.
Give us some examples of nude protests previously, and I call them naked protests because you know, nude is a, there's a nuance to it, which we don't necessarily have to go into. But just tell me about examples of this form of protest in the past.
Yeah, so when you go back to next door Kenya, in the times of Wangari Maathai, the Nobel Prize winner, she led an organization called the Green Belt Movement to defend a 2,500-acre forest in the heart of Nairobi from encroachment by the government and land grabbers. That was way back in September 1998, all through August 1999. That time she was protesting a brutal government led by then President Arap Moi. They did all manner of things, including naked protests. Then later, still under Moi in 1992, there's the Notorious Six. So it was a bunch of ladies whose children had been abducted by the Moi government. So these ladies protested for 11 months until Moi gave up and released their children. And then when you go down to South Africa, apartheid South Africa, we had naked protests, and also back up in British Nigeria in the 1920s, there were so many protests among the Igbo women pushing back on the excesses of colonialism. In modern day Uganda, we have Stella Nyanzi, a professor and a very respected, well-published professor who had a solo naked protest to push back against what she felt was administrative overreach by the people who run the largest university in Uganda.
What is the reaction generally to women protesting naked? We can look at different reactions from the colonial era to now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, so when you go back, I'll reference Wangari Maathai in her autobiography. She really positions the reason as to why naked protests are very powerful in our settings. She says that one of the most powerful of African traditions concerns the relationship between a woman and a man who could be her son. So we look at women as potential mothers or our mothers. Now, in a situation, in a society that is heavily patriarchal, the males will still look at the body of an older woman as sacred, as a temple of dignity. So if power pushes these women to undress and show their birth scars to the public, it is taken as a curse. It is frowned upon for one to make a woman undress. So in that regard, it's the woman's last tool to speak up against power and oppression. So in that regard, it's feared. And because of that fear that the exposure of a naked woman's body elicits, power has to somehow work around that and listen.
And does power listen?
Yeah, so when you look at the successful naked protests on the African continent, they just haven't happened overnight. It's not a flash protest where you just do it once and go home. The protest I referenced of the six mothers who are protesting the Moi government's abducting of their children, that protest took 11 months. The Green Belt Movement took more than a year. Wangari Maathai in February 1992, when she was protesting the building of a government office structure in Uhuru Park, I believe, yeah, that was 1992, yes. That protest took weeks. And it got her called a mad woman and a threat to the order and security of the country by the president. In Uganda, the president will say, well, a lot of these protests are funded by colonialists, colonial interests that just want to dictate how we live in this country. First, they ignore you, then they listen, and then they change. So it's a concerted effort that takes not just one night. It takes days of religiously pushing back until they listen and then they reform.
They do also visit violence, though, on the bodies of those women, don't they? We saw that in Uganda just recently.
Absolutely. Now, Uganda's situation is a bit nuanced. And again, I started by saying the power of naked protests for women largely lies in the shock value and the dignity that society accords to bodies of older women. Now, the nuance in Uganda comes in when the women are younger, and Uganda, as are many progressive countries this day, have started embracing nudity the same way you will see, say, the West embracing nudity as a celebration of the female body and freedom. So nudity in Uganda is ubiquitous. It's all over the place. It's an everyday thing. So for younger women, at least, it doesn't elicit that same shock that nudity of older women elicits. When you look at the Ugandan reaction to that nude protest, It was either strong defense of these women's rights to protest as enshrined in the Constitution, or it was deriding them and calling them all manner of names. Either that, and that's largely from people who support the government. And then there's these other ultra-conservatives who just look at it as debasing the female body that shouldn't happen anywhere in society. And then you have police raining on them. And really, usually, that's the normal response that you expect from authorities to certain types of protests. Our government is very fearful of civil unrest and all these things. And then there are undertones around foreign interference in our political processes and all that stuff. So largely, it draws the ire of government for good or bad reasons, I wouldn't say, but I think people should have a right to protest freely. Any form of protest is dangerous in Uganda, and we need to be cognizant of that fact and be creative around that process.
Yeah, how effective would you say naked protests are, given the fact that it's meant to shock and shame the authorities into responding to what people are asking for? The women are asking for.
Yes, absolutely. Now, the value of the power in naked protests is in the shock. Now, when you remove the shock by essentially rendering nudity a common occurrence in society, then you take away a very powerful weapon in pushback against excesses of power. So now we need to find a way of rediscovering the power of nakedness as a form of speech. And it's very difficult to do that in a society that has fully embraced nudity. If done over time, would that perceived nuisance, as the government called it, would that nuisance then compel them into trying to restore the order and basically say, you know what, we can't take this nuisance anymore. Let's do something about it. So probably it will move from using shock as a way to get people to feel so guilty and so bad and fix whatever problems ail society, or you will have to be such a nuisance over a repeated period of time to still get them to listen. And really, I believe that for society to change, you need a certain level of quote-unquote madness to be able to get people to listen to you and change. Because a lot of this abuse of power is what affords these leaders and politicians and, the people who run society, the comforts that come from them holding that power. So they will not give it away lightly until we make them uncomfortable. So do these nude protests actually work? In this day and age, once or twice, I do not think they'll work. They will just be mildly amusing and the news cycle will pass. And business as usual will happen. Now, if this happens over time and you have 1,000 women, 10,000 women hitting the streets, perhaps the powers that be will listen. But in the short term, I do not think nude protests are as effective as we want to think. As a conversation starter, absolutely. I mean, we are on the BBC having a conversation about them. We are accessing international media because of them. That's a win. But in terms of moving the needle in the sense that power will listen, it's extremely difficult to tell.
Okay. Thank you so much. That's been really interesting.
Thank you so much. Have a good one.
You too. Bye. That's Anthony Natif, an activist based in Kampala. For further analysis, do listen to the Focus on Africa podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Focus on Africa was pulled together by the titanic efforts of Alfonso Daniel, Bella Hassan and Yvette Twagira Maria here in London, and Susan Gashui in Nairobi. Kani Sharp was our senior journalist, Nick Randell, the technical producer, Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.
I'm Sumiso Maskander from the Global Story Podcast, where we're looking at the U.S. presidential debate, which much of the world was watching. Kamala Harris went up against Donald Trump in Philadelphia in the first face-off between the two ahead of November's election. What were the key takeaways? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.